and welcome to Season 3, Episode 11 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. Today, we started to a conversation with Marcus Dipsilas, who joined me in studio in Berlin to discuss his experience of truth being rooted in relationship. Justin also joined me in the studio in Berlin for the intro, so here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week in person for the first time. Well, hello.
And this is a unique opportunity.
I'm actually a little weirded out by this because I'm looking the same direction that I normally look when we record, but instead of looking at my tablet, I'm looking at you.
And how many episodes in are we?
Oh man, it's about 50. I don't know specifically.
In all the 50 episodes, I think we've never done one together in person where we've been in the same room. The only exception is we did one for some Patreon guests of ours,
right,
where we did, this wasn't posted as a normal episode, the one that I'm talking about. Yeah. So that was the only time we were ever together in the same room.
Right.
But for a regular normal recording, this is unique.
This is unique. It's really fun.
This is the first time professors have been in a room drinking coffee together at the same time.
That's true. This is professors in room.
Yeah. Professors in room rather than professors in rooms. This is great.
So what's a highlight for you this week?
Well, there's a lot of highlights because I've been in Europe for this whole week, but one of them, of course, being that we're together in the same room at the same place, yeah. But also—
Wait. I'm sorry. What are you drinking for coffee? Oh,
you tell me. You made this for me. So it is—
true. This is a Colombian coffee.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And
from which machine? What's it called?
From the brand is Chibo.
Chibo. Oh yeah. The same coffee shop we tried to go to.
Yeah.
So it's a Chibo machine and we're drinking this. And for the listeners' interest, this is coffee number what today?
This is number three, four actually for me. Did you have coffee at breakfast?
I did.
I also
four
did.
For me.
Four for me too. You know, it's okay. It's been a busy week for me. It's been a busy week for you too. We'll take it.
Exactly.
Although I have to say, I think my third cup of coffee was probably my favorite. Not because of the coffee, although it was good, but because of the honey walnut cake that we had.
Oh man, that was so good. That's where I first learned about the idea of coffee and cake time.
Yeah, café und Kuchen. It's so good.
Usually Americans, when it comes to finding creative ways to eat more, it's not a problem. But for some reason, we don't have coffee and cake time.
Why do we not have coffee and cake time?
But the thing is about it, it's not just that it's a great time. It's that it's great cake too.
That's true.
So this coffee shop, which is a chain, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Had a very good cake.
It was quite good.
Like we're not just talking, yeah, it meets the standards. We're talking like, this is the kind of thing you'd get at a pretty—
like I would buy that cake for my family for something special.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. It would also be very expensive to buy a whole cake.
That's true. It's like in Minneapolis, technically St. Paul, we have Cafe Latte. Have you been there?
No.
And it's a similar kind of thing where they just bake their own cakes.
Okay.
Cost about the same amount per slice, but it's also known as being like some of the best cake in the city because they make their own cake and it's not prepackaged.
Yeah. And I can tell you, there are definitely places that have a higher level around here. Yeah.
And if it's higher than this is pretty good honey cake.
It was very good. Yeah.
So there was the honey cake that made it a good cup, but there's also the fact that it was the first cup of the day, I think, well, at least for me, that I drank out of a actual cup and not a paper cup.
That's true. Yeah. It was sitting down, ceramic cup. Yeah.
Good coffee in bad cups sometimes isn't as good as okay coffee in a good cup.
I think you're right. Yeah. Yep.
So there's some highlights, but I mean, I have lots of highlights because I've had some fun experiences here in Europe, but related to today, I'll narrow down a bit because it's related to experiences we were able to have together today, not only in just seeing you and actually spending some time with Mike Picanato today as well, but also having an opportunity to go around the city with you guys, the city of Berlin, and to check out some important historical sites, some things that tell the narrative of things that happened during World War II, but also happened during the post-war era as it relates to the East and West Berlin. That was a fascinating experience.
A lot of those things in and of themselves are fairly non-highlight things, right? Mm. Like a lot of them are fairly heavy. But yeah, the getting to consider history where it happened is always super interesting.
And the reason it's a highlight for me is because there's something really fascinating about being, I'm not just learning history, which I love. I'm really convinced if I didn't do biblical studies, I would do history as a subject.
That makes sense because you did so much history in your PhD anyway.
Yeah, that's true. But there's something about being present in these historical locations where really significant things happen that can arouse the imagination in a way to be thinking about the significance of those events, but also in just reflecting on them in a different way than if you're just reading it out of a book or looking at it on Google Maps.
I think too, there's something like realizing, okay, this was a thing that actually happened in this place with real people, maybe prompts the questions of, could this happen where I live with real people that I know or something like it, something unthinkable. Yeah.
And even with the hotel we're staying at is in what would have been East Berlin. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, even last night, just sitting in our hotel thinking if we were to rewind the clock, I guess I got to do my math now, 30.
Yeah, just over 30 years.
Some years, the different experience we would have had being in that building at that time or being on that location, even if the building wasn't there.
Right.
It's a fascinating thing to think about.
Well, especially because that at least to people like us doesn't feel like that long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially it's in our own lifetime.
Right.
Yeah. So those were highlights, getting a different experience of the city, getting to spend the day with you guys. That was great. Yeah. How about for you?
Yeah. I mean, this week also has had a ton of highlights for me. We had a team from Omaha here, which was a lot of fun. Yeah. And then I finished up my fourth week of class at the language school that I've been at. I did every other week there. So it was 2 months of class. Not that I'm done with language school, but I'm done with that set of what I was doing. So that felt good. And then of course, last night hanging out with you and the family, and then today getting to go around and just be in places. It was funny. I woke up this morning. I was like, wait, Justin's here in Berlin. And it's a quick trip, cause you guys will be headed out tomorrow, but I think, so I feel like there are a lot of just really nice moments from this week, which has been good.
That's great. Yeah. And there's, it's like worlds colliding, right? Because we had time that we spent together so frequently in Minnesota when we were working together.
Right.
And then we had the period where we weren't seeing each other, for one, because you weren't teaching anymore and you're transitioning into your new role with Envision Berlin. And then you guys moved and we weren't seeing each other, not face to face.
Yeah.
And then, so now the world's kind of coming back together of spending face to face time together. That's fun.
Yeah.
So what's been a low light for you?
A low light. I mean, absolutely the shooting in Texas.
Yeah. That's,
I think, as well as the release of the Southern Baptist report, dealing with how that denomination had, dealt with or not dealt well with, or dealt very badly with, situations of abuse. Yeah. And, I think the feeling sometimes of not really knowing what to hope for in terms of, like, I feel like long-term I have good hope. But I feel like in terms of the short term and looking at questions of social problems and organizational problems and church problems, man, sometimes it just gets so heavy. And then I think even I noticed in myself an unwillingness to really engage actually the pain
of
Texas. And I don't know that that's necessarily inappropriate in some ways, right? Like I don't live there and I have very real things that I need to be paying attention to here. But I don't want to get comfortable not engaging pain, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I felt a little bit that way as well. And part of it's because of having little kids, and it's a painful thing to have to put yourself in that spot and think about what if those are your kids, And that's a very difficult thing to try to think about all the ins and outs of the conversations happening in the US and trying to navigate helpful conversations about what could be solutions to stopping these kinds of things from happening, but feeling almost a complete sense of hopelessness right. when it comes to saying, are we anywhere close to finding the solution?
I mean, I feel like we're so much further than we were when, I mean, cause I was in, I think, were you in high school also when Columbine happened? Yeah. Yeah. And, I think.
Which
I
was like the first event. It's like a, gosh, I don't even know what to call it. It was just the first event that awoke us. Yeah. I'm sure that things had happened before.
I don't know that anything quite like that had happened before. Nothing
quite like that. And then now that's happened. Like, has there been a year since that happened where something like that didn't happen?
I don't think so. Yeah. And I think I just, yeah, I do feel very much like we're further away from solving it now than we were then as a society. And that is deeply troubling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's especially troubling in thinking about theological and pastoral responses to those situations where maybe the only legitimate reply would be a lament and a plea and a cry. Mm-hmm. Because there's what else, it feels hopeless. And I wouldn't say that in a Christian theological sense, it's hopeless, but I would just say it feels hopeless in that I don't think there's just an easy answer where it's like, hey, if we do this, or worse off, maybe there is an easy answer and we're unwilling to engage it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I was talking with, the team that was here this week. Mm. And so certainly that came up, although it was toward the end of their time here. So we didn't have a lot of time to engage it, but yeah, I think the question of what does it mean to, well, okay. So we were talking about recent social issues, and what does it look like to be people of faith when there are different things going on and the temptation to take sides and the temptation to try to be on the, I don't know if temptation is the right word, but often this draw to be on the right side and how sometimes that pull to be on the right side can really lead us away from pursuing who God is and what the will of God is, which is something Bonhoeffer wrestled with, talked about. There's this way in which on the one hand, theology sometimes feels really, really almost very distant. I have hope eternally, right? But then what does it look like practically right now? And sometimes my obsession or our obsession with trying to be on the right side is actually evidence that our hope is more in ourselves and our ability to pick the right side and our ability to rightly decide what is good. And maybe sometimes as people of faith, we're not necessarily even called to be on a side. I don't know, but I feel like there are really practical outworkings of some of those things, but I also feel like, and I was talking with the team about this, I feel like some of those thoughts actually get kind of dangerous. Like I think some of Bonhoeffer's thoughts actually get kind of dangerous and trying to figure out how do I not just be wise in my own eyes. And I'm a complete muddle in terms of how that all looks right now.
What's been hard to swallow, especially is hearing some reports on Twitter and other places of social media of just some of the experiences of what parents have had to go through in losing their children. And it reminds me a lot of seeing that documentary on the Sandy Hook shooting.
I haven't seen it.
And it's hard. It's the hardest thing to watch. It's just a real life horror film of hearing stories of parents being brought to, fire station. And they're all gathered together. None of them know if their kids are safe or not. They know something's happened. Something bad's happened. They maybe knew they were shooting. I can't remember, but I think I just recently saw a report on how for Sandy Hook, what happened was parents kept leaving, which meant that their kids were safe. And then with the last parents in there, they basically made an announcement. Like if you're still here, it's because your kids are gone.
Wow.
And they said, they just heard wailing outside and there are similar reports coming out from this incident too. And I think I just can't imagine what that'd be like. And, and I think what's hard is that all these things can become politicized into various conversations about gun control and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it's like, if you're a parent who's lost your kid that way, like I could see, how could you not dedicate the rest of your life to trying to solve the problem? Like, or be part of a society that says my kid didn't die just because we're, have bad policy or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did I ask you about a low light?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I certainly sympathize with you on all these things, so I can add that. Like, I could count that as my low light too. But I guess on a little bit of a lighter note, I thought your low light was going to be that when you came to meet us last night, my kids were absolutely just throwing a fit. Jill's like, oh boy, the Joneses, they got the best taste. Our kids had been 13 days into a trip here of Europe, and Theo, you know, who's five, is just losing it. I mean, like, where he's in the stroller and we're having to stroll him around while our youngest is being carried because he's fine. And I mean, you saw it. So it's funny. I did try to remind Jill. I said, hey, look, like they've got three kids. I'm sure they've hit some of this at some point as well. So it's okay. But it was just kind of a funny moment where it's literally like we had literally just seen you and it wasn't a matter of seconds before like he lost it.
That's
so
funny. I would say that is an expected incidental. And so, yeah.
But as a parent, it's like, it doesn't matter how many times this happens. It's just never easy to actually deal with any, you know, it can happen in your home. It can happen outside the home, but every time that your kids lose it and you can tell that it's probably not anything logical. They're probably over hungry, over tired, and you're trying to calm a situation. And usually in those circumstances, there isn't an easy calm.
There just isn't anything.
It's like, they just almost have to get it out of them.
Yep.
And so it's one of those moments where those are the most trying sometimes as parents, where you're trying to like, you know, hey, here are our friends who we've flown all this way to see. And all of a sudden now it's just,
yeah, no, that's, yeah.
So if that's not your low light, then maybe I'll count it as mine.
That's funny. Yeah, no, we enjoyed the time with you guys, and it was noticeable. We got a little bit of food into your kids' bellies, and then they found a fountain, and there was happiness until the wind blew the thing away.
But anyway. That's right. Oh, you mean our youngest, was he eating some? He's eating a snack or something.
Something,
yeah. And he was all done with it, but right. he had the wrapper, and then the wind blew it, and then it was just like again devastation. That wrapper, you really wanted that wrapper.
That's so funny. Yeah,
I'll count that then as my low light.
Nice. What's an insight for you?
Oh man, the insight. Do you have an insight already?
I think an insight for me is that I'm realizing I have been looking forward for a while as far as I could see, which wasn't super far, but you know, so like we had this team here, we had a bunch of stuff. The last 2 months were just incredibly busy. And then as soon as the team left, so they left yesterday morning and we had class, and then we got done with class. And then you guys were scheduled to arrive about 15 minutes later, and then ended up a little delayed. So we got a little nap in there, which was nice. Yes. But then I'm looking forward and realizing like, I have not really thought much about this next month. I've got a couple of markers. And then we had a conference that is scheduled that the location just got changed. And so, but I think the thing of realizing like sometimes when you have so much right in front of you and you can't see kind of past that, that then suddenly there are these moments where you're like, what do I even do with myself? Like I'm realizing like, okay, tomorrow you guys will be off to the airport. And then and that's kind of how I feel about it. You know, it's like kind of like, I've got
now what?
Yeah. And I know there are a lot of things, but yeah, just kind of, it's interesting how life kind of goes in different seasons, and we haven't learned the seasons here yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I think, and I'm thinking about that from a little different angle where, for a long time we had a pretty intense end of the semester, and it's like, ooh, looking forward to graduation, looking forward to going on a trip. Yeah, and then now that's kind of almost in the rearview mirror here. I mean, you almost get this sense of loss, right? Of
like, absolutely. That's what I'm feeling.
Oh man, I've been looking forward to this the whole time. And then now it's there and gone.
Yeah.
And then the, what is next thing feels like, oh, there's nothing big on the schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's like, I mean, when I thought the conference that we were going to go to was originally going to be in the U well, originally it was going to be somewhere else, and then it was going to be in the US, and then now it's not going to be in the US. And so, things where I thought I was going to see people and whatnot, and I'm having to adjust expectations, and just this feeling of like, oh, I don't know. Like, it feels like actually I'm entering into a season of loss that I hadn't realized was coming. Yeah. Our teammates, a couple of them are going to be gone on, for a few months. And yeah. And so I think we've had a season where there's been a lot of activity and a lot of stuff coming at us. And then now, yeah, kind of this season of like, oh, I suddenly feel kind of sad and I don't like it.
Yeah. 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 I know that that's a weird thing about how, I feel like it's always good to be planning the next kind of cool event in some ways, whatever it might be, just to have something to look forward to, not because like the rest of life is all that bad or anything,
right.
But because it just kind of gets, it orients you a certain way.
Yeah.
It's very eschatological, right?
It is. Like, it's like a micro-eschatology.
There you go, micro-eschatology, right? You got these little moments to look forward to of like pointing toward.
Not a pinnacle of history, but maybe a pinnacle of the year.
Pinnacle of the year. Yeah. And
pinnacle of the quarter.
And there's something even theological about the look forward to moments because they kind of like are a reminder, a little taste on this side of eternity of how like there are these joyful things that come up. And then maybe there's also this, I don't know what would it be if I don't know if it'd be eschatological, but it would be something where as it's passing.
Yeah.
And you're getting that sense of sadness. There's something almost theological there too.
I
of
think
like
there is
that of like, sense of,
I mean, even the sense of this isn't our home.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Yeah. Right. Like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that time. And then this side of eternity, as time passes, that means sometimes joy is in the rearview mirror.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Which is good. Cause it gives you a reference point as you think about future joy.
Yeah.
But yeah. It also doesn't necessarily make things easy now.
No.
How about you? What's an insight?
Oh man, I don't know. I'm now you got me thinking about those kinds of things. I think I'll play off that just in reiterating what I said a bit of that sense of the looking forward to coming on a trip, seeing you guys, seeing our good friends who we just visited with in Prague and all the plans, even months of plans that you have as you're scoping out locations and what you might do when you get there, and thinking now back even over the course of the last 2 weeks, all the fun that we've had. And then now seeing that in the rear view mirror and thinking about jumping on a plane tomorrow, going home and getting back to the routine.
Right.
There's certainly something that feels like on the end of every trip, that you're kind of looking forward to going home.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's also that sense of loss that makes it feel like, dang, I wish it wouldn't end right now.
It is nice though. There is something good about walking back in the door at home.
Yeah.
You know? And I think maybe that also has kind of an eschatological feel to it too, right? Of like a place of belonging and Well, thanks. This has been fun.
Doing this live for the first time ever.
First time ever.
And in Berlin, which is great. Let's hope that there are more of these on the docket for us in the future. I'd love to do this again and maybe even more fuller episodes together somehow.
That would be fun.
That'd be great.
Absolutely.
Nice. Well, till next time.
Till next time. Wanted to let you know we'd love to engage with topics you're wondering about in an upcoming episode. So we invite you to send in questions for free through our Patreon channel. They can be about themes we've talked about, questions you have about us, ideas for future episodes, and more. Check it out at patreon.com/profsandrooms. So today we have another guest with me here in the studio in Berlin. And with me is Marcus Dipsilas, who is a former digital nomad who's spent a significant amount of time in over 18 countries working on projects and networking by immersing himself among local cultural communities. He graduated with a bachelor's in intercultural studies from Cowan College, where Justin teaches in Minnesota, and has a graduate diploma in international development from the London School of Economics. He'll begin seminary studies soon and is again here with me in Berlin, where he just performed a Schaufenster concert a couple of days ago. Marcus, welcome.
Hello.
Oh, hold on a second. What?
I didn't know Deutsch. That's right.
No, wait, you performed a concert a few days ago in Berlin.
I did.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, it was a window concert, which in a different city in Europe would mean a very different kind of thing. I'm talking about Amsterdam, but it was a window concert in the Envision Berlin office space or the gallery space, I guess. And just put a piano and a screen up, and then I put a little show on of music and storytelling.
It was about what, maybe 30 minutes or so, and
30, 35, yeah, somewhere there, yeah.
Yeah, on a Saturday evening, and it was great. There were a lot of people that stopped by. There were, I don't know, maybe 40 or so people that stopped and watched most of it or a long part of it. And then probably another 100 people that slowed down as they were on their way somewhere. So it's very nice.
Yeah.
Wait, so people could hear from the outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a speaker outside too.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's great.
So it's kind of, yeah, I was busking indoors.
That's true. Your tips were rather pitiful.
As in none.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I put together like a playlist of sorts. Like I did covers of popular songs, but to kind of a soundtrack of my life type situation or narrative, I guess. And had a presentation where I just talked about my life and then had a song that would connect somehow to it. It was a lot of fun preparing for and doing, and appreciated the opportunity to do that. Yeah.
It was nice. So the building that we're in has homes above us, you know, it's an apartment building above the ground level. And one of the neighbors came down and, you know, there's always this question of, I hope we're not bothering them. But our colleague was talking with her and she said, well, no, I'm just curious. Like, how could one not be curious when one is sitting in their living room and suddenly there's music happening? So,
Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly aware of your musical talents from when you were at Crown, but also in case our listeners haven't kept up on our whole series, you also provided us with a wonderful piece of music right after George Floyd was killed. And I remember that being a powerful piece of music that you helped us to use to reflect on that moment. And so thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This also isn't your first time on this podcast. You've been here. Yeah. Once before,
I'm a twofer now.
Yeah.
Well, that means, so I want to start with our usual question, but I'm interested to find out then if your answer has changed since the last time we talked, because as you're well aware, we usually start by asking folks what the best cup of coffee is that they've ever had. So is your answer the same from, I don't remember actually what your answer was last time. So right. I apologize. I didn't look at the archives. Sorry, before our recording. So what is the best cup of coffee you've ever had? And when did you start liking coffee?
Right. So the answer that I would have given at that time, which we talked about, was about 2 years ago now, maybe a little less than 2 years, but was that the best cup of coffee was the espresso I had the morning that I was on a trip to go propose to my then fiance.
I think that's what you said. That rings
was
a bell.
What I said. Yeah.
Yeah.
So of course, since then, I mean, in terms of memories, nothing will top that cup, I think, but I only started drinking coffee in the year 2021. And I think my entryway into it was because I was, as a ritual, I guess, in Malaysia to ground myself, I frequently would make Lauren, my wife, coffee. And that involved grinding the beans, weighing everything out, kind of figuring out a ratio that I cater to her taste a little bit. And so the smells of freshly ground coffee, doing the pour over, that really centered me. And then last year, we had a coffee shop open 5 minutes from 5 minutes drive from our place. And then I went in and got a latte just to try. And I've loved lattes ever since. So there's no sugar or syrup in mine. I just do iced coffee, basically. And then now kind of getting into espressos. Yeah. So I would say the best cup of coffee in the last 2 weeks have been the cups of coffee that I've been making myself, because I'm very particular about what my coffee ends up tasting.
If you're weighing beans and all that to make your wife a cup of coffee, you must have this down to an art, because I'm well aware of that method in order to make a good cup of coffee. I've just been too lazy to get myself a scale and do all the weighing. So I just eyeball it.
Yeah. Cause it's about 10 to 15 minutes. And the friends that we're staying with in America don't have a manual grinder for pour over espresso. And so when you have to manually grind coffee, you've really got to want to do it.
But that's got to smell so good.
It does. It really does. And that's, I think that's what got me was, I like dark chocolate. I should maybe try a little bit of coffee. And then slowly, now it doesn't hit me the same way it used to in terms of, oh, this is too bitter. Now it's, you know, I can get the notes out of it and stuff. So yeah, I went from not drinking coffee to snob in like very short time.
Yeah. Nice.
Oh, welcome to the world of legal drug addiction.
Well, I've been medicating for years, you know, so.
I shouldn't have put it that way.
We all cope somehow, but.
Yep.
So this season, we're talking about truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness. And one of the things that we, as Justin and I were talking about this season before it got started, that we wanted to pay attention to is that there are cultural differences in the way that those things are understood, what they mean, how people reason about them. And so I thought it'd be really interesting while you're here to talk with you about that. But I thought it might be helpful both for us and for the audience, if you could kind of give us a little bit of background, what are your cultural reference points? So when you're thinking about kind of where you stand and you're looking at the world, what cultural lenses are informing what you see?
Yeah. So mine is called confusion.
So just to be clear, you said confusion and not Confucian?
Correct. Okay. Confusion. Right. Yeah. Although it's deeply steeped in Confucianism. I think more recently, the way I interact with the world is through ambiguity. So I have begun to approach things from a, I don't know, and I'm okay not knowing kind of lens, I would say. And that is both informed by my time spent as an international student in America, as a digital nomad, even my own upbringing. I think because there is no box that can hold all three lenses at the same time, I've kind of had to make a new, I wouldn't call it a box, just make a new containment unit.
Because even in your culture where you grew up, you were in some ways a third cultural kid, right? A third culture kid.
Yeah. Yeah. So my background is I'm biracial, more than biracial, multiracial. My mom is fully Chinese, although even that in itself has its complexities because clans differ in terms of language and their perspective on life and food and what it means to live.
And she's fully Chinese, but grew up in Malaysia, right?
Right.
Because there's a large Chinese community.
Yes. So her ancestors migrated to Malaysia from southern China quite early on. And then my dad is Punjabi, North Indian, and Pakistani Malay, which in itself also has its complexities. And they came over to Malaysia as traders. Also years ago. So the Indian side and the Chinese side, and then growing up in Southeast Asia with a very unique Malaysian kind of mix, and then not being fully anything kind of informed my perspective on growing up. I was not full Chinese. I was not full Indian. So can borrowed from different places, mix and match that perspective. Yeah.
And then did college in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then did your graduate work through London. And
right. That was online. So I didn't attend a program there.
Gotcha.
But while I was doing the program, I was traveling around the world and doing different things. Yeah. I remember sitting in your office, actually, Jones, on one particularly hard day of cultural transition and kind of telling you that I felt like I fit nowhere and I was really angsty and upset about it. And you looked at me and you said, well, why not create your own culture? To which I responded, are you crazy? And you can put the bleep button.
Oh.
Are you crazy?
wait. When do we get buttons?
Oh, we've got buttons.
Hold on a second here. Yeah. What? We got buttons? Wait, do we have other fun features? Yeah. Wow. Well, we'll explore this later, but wait, that beep. If I would have known there was a beep this whole time, I would have tried to utilize that multiple occasions.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you?
So,
go ahead.
Go
sorry,
ahead.
Justin.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say you had mentioned that you said are you? Wait. Let's try that again. Are you? Here you go. Beep me. Are you? crazy. Is that what you said?
You need to work on the timing. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I said to Jones. Probably did use the bad word. Expletive. I probably use, yeah, the cuss word. But that seems such a far concept to me at the time that who was I to be an authority to create my own culture? But as the years went by, learning that, you know, that's what basically someone else did. Mm. They just one day up and created something, and then people thought it made sense and then they followed it. So for me, definitely morphing the different parts of myself into a framework that I can understand, which is still a work in progress. But that's taken time and also courage to do, because, you know, it sometimes feels very lonely to walk that path.
And then your wife is white US American. Mm-hmm. How does that fit into your blend of cultures that influence right. how you see the world?
I would say she keeps me honest. Yeah, because I mean, the temptation is always to then consider my way superior. I think that's the trauma response, and the way to validate it to myself is that the only way I can use this if it is superior to other people's frameworks or other people's lenses. And then cue my wife coming in and being, that's ridiculous. Mm. So I would say that helps a lot. And she's not particularly political in the sense of picking sides. She is very well read and she is well kept informed, I would say, sometimes more than me, to perspectives that are different than hers, more willing to listen, I would say, at times. So she is a very precious resource to me to make sure that I don't go off the deep end on my own. Yeah.
So maybe then we can just start with mm-hmm. the wide open and potentially dangerous question of what is truth? Mm.
Well, I can only speak for myself, really, right? Because as a postmodernist millennial, I mean, I'm
thinking like immediately we've gone down a certain epistemological path.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I guess how I interact with truth is, to me, it is truth is loving, and truth is, in that it is loving, is relational, or perhaps truth is relational in relation, it is loving. Of course, that means different things to different people. I think being loving involves both speaking up for what is true, but with the intention of the person who is hearing it. So for me, to be truthful to myself is to not let myself be misguided, especially when it comes to examining what I actually believe or what I think. My tendency is to want to please others with affirming statements of what they are saying. And so to be truthful to myself often looks like, if I disagree, I do need to speak up about it. I try not to be a jerk about it. I don't think I am. If people interact with me and I try and I'm being truthful, it tends to be around having a meal if we are in the same location. So food plays a role in truth for me, truth telling. But truth ultimately to me is and can be objective. I just don't think that any culture or any person has monopoly on what objectivity means, or that they possess objective truth in and of themselves.
That's an interesting point. I was wondering if we'd maybe be able to talk about this, because I appreciated what you said earlier about when you're speaking about sort of your cultural frameworks and all the places you've been and the ways that culture shaped you in your own life. You talked about, I think the word you used was ambiguity, mm-hmm. right? Which is such an interesting concept when talking about truth, because I think a lot of Christian people in particular think that ambiguity is sort of the enemy of truth, because right. truth has to be clear, mm-hmm. truth has to be known, and truth has to be always easily accessible. Mm-hmm. So in thinking about how you've talked about briefly your comfortability with ambiguity, mm-hmm. how do you think that relates to the way that you see truth?
Right. And even that itself comes from a context of being, as a Christian, I grew up a minority in my own context. We covered this when we were talking about power in the first or second season that I was on the podcast. So I grew up as a minority, but also a minority Christian in a country that was formerly colonized. So I have a post-colonial perspective on things and quite possibly a lingering post-colonial angst that for many years I didn't have the vocabulary to express, and how that informs my view of truth and ambiguity is truth was decided by the powers that be long before I came up, long before I came along, right? That somebody decided that this was what was going to be propagated as truth. And I'm not saying that truth is relative then, but what I'm saying is that to pretend like people don't have a say in what's true, I think that's kind of deceiving ourselves a little bit there.
I think one of the things that's really interesting that you're bringing up is, I think when I've asked students, many of the students that I've had from the US will tend to respond to the question, what is true, with some kind of an appeal to authority. And part of what your lived experience growing up in a post-colonial context gives you is this recognition that sometimes authority purports something to be true for some reason other than the truthfulness of the thing that's being claimed to be true.
Right. So there's a question of integrity then, right? Like who benefited from this particular truth being true. And for me, as a brown person living in this world, I feel like it's never been for me. Or the benefit of truth has never been for me. Now, I'm not saying that I don't benefit from things being true, and not that I don't see truth. For me, Jesus is true. He's the central part of my faith and what I understand to be truth. However, as I have traveled, it would be remiss to not interact with ambiguity, because when I interact with believers from other contexts, I cannot help but see like my quote unquote truth is not complete. And I think that's part of the saying right now, like what is true for you might not be true for someone else. And I see that inversely, actually, is, you know, my truth is not, I don't see the whole picture. I can't. I mean, that is not why I was created. I wasn't created to be a single unit, perfectly functioning, formed unit, right? Like I need other people to inform my perspective. I need other people's lives and truths to be somehow part of me. And that involves both, you know, believers and what they believe about God, but also non-believers and what they think about the world, because not everything that they think is untrue. So if I have traveled all these years and that has not been a part of my process, then I would think that's been a giant waste of money, really. And I was just a tourist, which I don't like being a tourist. I like to be in things. Yeah.
This brings part one of the conversation with Marcus to a close. Join us next time for the next part of this discussion about relational truth. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.